All right, I think we can get started. Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome. I noticed I made a mistake the last 2 weeks, so I have to thank David Callender, our great tech guy who posts all our recordings, all the hundreds and thousands of recording. David Callender's been working for us. None of you have ever met him, really, except for 20 years, actually. He's been recording our programming when we first got started, and he would come to things and, and put cassettes in the olden days. Anyway, so he noticed that somehow I switched from 111 to 118, and he thought I confused the one and the seven, and I was correct. So I think I said last week was class 117, 18. Anyways, this is class 113. For anybody who's actually paying attention and going through all the classes one by one on the sitter, I don't know who's doing that, but anyway, so this, please God, is class 100. I'm sorry, this is class 114. Last week was 113 on the sitter. And we've had a few, in the middle where we've done other subjects when the timing is off. But anyways, okay, let's see how much we can finish, perhaps the second paragraph of the Shema today. So we're up to, let's discuss, really, we discussed the reward, punishment, big discussion. And last week we discussed mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael, the primacy of the land of Israel, even for mitzvot that are not dependent on the land. And on the one hand, the Sifri has that amazing comment that what this it seems to see the simple meaning of the verses in the Shema. God will get mad, he'll throw you out of land and put on tefillin. Well, what does tefillin have to do with the land? It's not a mitzvah on the land. Nonetheless, the Sifri quotes the Midrash, rabbinic Midrash, that even though it's mitzvah, not connected land, you still have to do them outside in Israel for practice for when you come back. There's a very nice idea, and there is something to that, but we discuss that. I don't know that it's really, we accept that halachically. I don't know that there's anybody really says that there's really, I don't think, a real difference between the mitzvah of mezuzah in Chutz La'aretz and the mitzvah of mezuzah in the land of Israel. Okay, we discussed obviously different views, how important the centrality of living in Israel is and why the Rambam doesn't count it as a mitzvah. Doesn't mean the Rambam doesn't consider it's important, but the Rambam does not famously count the mitzvah to live in Israel. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, I guess perhaps in contemporary, it's not, okay, I know he's not, but relatively contemporary authorities, also I think relatively famously said that the mitzvah to live in Israel, there's no obligation to live in Israel. If you live in Israel, it's wonderful. You get a mitzvah. But it's not like eating matzah, that you have to eat matzah. It's like tzitzis. That's right. You don't have to wear a four-corner garment. If you want to, you do. You put it on, you get a mitzvah. But I think I once mentioned a long time ago, unfortunately, this tshuva of Rav Moshe was discussed, Yossi Glatt, Hashem Yikom Damo. He was in Sheva Kisufim, I believe, in Bnei Kiva. I'm in Sheva Golan for the old Bnei Kiva Zips. So I think he was a year ahead of me. And he was killed in the terrorist attack in Beit Hadassah and Hebron, like 1980, I believe it was. And it was a budding Talmud Chacham, and he had written a lot of stuff, like write notes. And after he died, they published his books, Me'afar Kumi, I believe it's called, a little, whatever, 100 pages of his ideas on Israel. And in there, he had, I don't want to say attacked, he had disagreed with, like a 20-year-old kid, disagreed with Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he said that he wanted to bring all the sources that, you are obligated to live in Israel. It's not just nice if you do it and you get a mitzvah. And he wrote all his reasons why, and they sent it to Rav Moshe Feinstein to write a haskama. And usually, if you know anything about how haskamot work, when you get a regular book, a secular book. So, they have people writing on the back, what a wonderful book it is, and et cetera. Unfortunately, or whatever, just the way the nature of Haskamot in the Jewish world, that's not how they work. The Haskamot, I mean, occasionally they do books in English, they work like that. But in many of the Sfarim, especially halachic books written in English, Pearson writes, I didn't really have time to read the book. I don't really know English very well. I don't know. I don't. Rav Moshe Feinstein had a policy, a very understandable policy. He never gave a haskam on a book of halacha. He never said, a great book, because He said, I might disagree with a lot of things in the book, which I'm entitled to. We've discussed many times where Moshe would always say, you know, there are other rabbis who can support the Erev in Manhattan, even though I think it's no good, but I'm not the only rabbi. Other rabbis say it is good, so you give money, even though I think they're violating the Shabbat. They don't. So, I mean, the Rav Moshe, that's great openness. So Rav Moshe says, I don't give haskamas on halakhic books because I don't necessarily agree. So he would write a bracha to the author. He's a nice person. He should merit to spread lots of Torah. So and he would all write, I don't have time to read the book. My English isn't very good, etc. You'll notice when art scroll, they translate books, they never translate the haskamot. Because it's to someone who's not from that world, it sounds very strange. Somebody writing, well, I didn't read the book, but. So what do you mean you didn't read the book? So what did he tell me about the book? They would bless the author. But in this particular case, of course, because of the tragedy, you know, the nature of the situation, Rav Moshe writes that, you know, he got the book. He read the chapter that he wrote. Very nice. And he explained why he still disagreed. He didn't change his mind. Like Rav Moshe didn't change his mind after reading the chapter. It's a very whatever, what can I say? But that's Rav Moshe's famous thing. Okay, we'll leave it at that. And let's move on to Vilimadatam Otam Epinecha. Now, to teach your children. Okay, so who wants to tell me what's the difference between, I mean, is this just repetition? Which, by the way, many of the commentaries pretty much say that the second paragraph is really just a repetition of the first. Even the things that don't sound totally repetitious, it's all the pretty much love of God is mentioned, accepting mitzvot, doing mitzvot. And here towards the end, it's really, really repetitive. In other words, it's the same words. Tefillin, mezuzah, teaching Torah, it's almost the exact same of the first paragraph. So I'm saying, okay, the Torah's reiterating it, fine. But what is there a difference between bishinantam levanecha, which is an interesting word, you should make them sharp, whatever you should teach them to your children, and vilimadatam otam epinechem leverbam. What is the difference? Maybe, is there a difference?
Maybe here it's referring to galus, because it comes right after.
Galus. Oh, if you want to continue on the same thing, that you have to learn Torah even in chutz laretz.
Because it was a question of whether we need to keep mitzvos at all. So here it's saying not only do you need to keep the mitzvos, but you also need to continue the mesorah. It's especially important outside of in
Galus. Very interesting. So, you know, it's very interesting. And you got me thinking, I just off the top of my head, you know, the Torah, right, there is no mitzvah really to learn Torah in the Torah. I know that sounds really strange. The mitzvah is you have to teach Torah. The mitzvah of teaching Torah, of learning Torah, is v'shinanta levanecha and v'limanatam atam epanechem. These two verses, the Gemara, it's this verse actually, more, I think, in the second paragraph of the Shema, that's the mitzvah to teach your test to learn Torah. There is no mitzvah to learn. The mitzvah is to teach, which is fascinatingly and I think crucially important. In order to teach, you have to learn. But the mitzvah is structured is in an idea of teaching Torah. Learning Torah for yourself, not so important. You have Torah, you have to share it with others. Primarily your children, that's how the Torah provides it. But we know our students are our children, everybody. But that is the mitzvah. And the Talmud actually says that only if somebody teaches you do you have an obligation to learn, and then you have an obligation to teach. And that's where we discussed this a long time ago. And that's why, you know, on the fundamental level, women do not have an obligation to learn Torah. I'm sure people know this. There are really two aspects of learning Torah. Women have an equal obligation to men. I would say a greater obligation. In the real world, women have a greater obligation than men to know Hilchot Kashrut and Hilchot Mikvaot and Hilchot Shabbos generally. I'm not saying that's just the way we socially live. It's still, I think, women, even in the more liberated homes, still do more cooking than their husbands. And for sure, the mikvah, obviously, and Shabbos. So a woman has to learn more Torah than the man. The mitzvah to learn practical aspects, that's not a mitzvah to learn Torah. In order to know how to hear shofar, you have to know the laws of shofar. In order to know how to make kiddush, you have to learn the book kiddush. So that mitzvah to learn Torah, the idea that we learn Torah so we can keep the mitzvah, which is how the Torah always presents it. You should shmartem basitem. The idea of learning is to do. Rav Schachter, you know, that was his basic thing. The whole, you know, the whole goal of learning is to know halacha. That's why Rav Schachter focuses so much on halacha. He doesn't go like this the Brisker style sort of departed from halakha. It's a more theoretical. The Rav and halakhic man describes halakha as like boring. I don't like boring. It's like a car mechanic. You know, you have to know how to fix the car. But in the ideal halakha, the ideal halakhic man is living in the world of ideas and concepts. And, you know, as he always quotes the famously, Reb Chaim took the pots and pans out of the kitchen and made them into concepts, you know, what they represent, the ideas they represent. But as some people say, you know, there's still pots and pans in the kitchen. You still have to know if the pot is kosher or not. So that's really two different approaches, but the Briskers really changed the whole approach, and that revolutionized the world. But the classical way of learning was you learned in order to know what to do. A kitzur Shulchan Aruch, your Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah. Here's what you do. They weren't. Rambam says, don't learn Gemara. It's the exact opposite. It's very ironic and cute. The Brisker whole system is based on the Rambam. Everything in the Brisker style of learning. It's the Rambam. It's based on the Rambam. The Rambam was the one who said, you don't learn Gemara. You don't learn analysis. Here's what you got to do. Learn philosophy. So it's just very fascinating. But everybody agrees on some level. Is it 98% of learning Torah or only 10% of learning Torah? But there is a mitzvah. You have to learn Torah to know what to do. So that everybody agrees. Men and women are equal, and perhaps women have a greater obligation than man. But that's sort of learning Torah is what we call a heksher mitzvah. I learn Torah to know how to do the mitzvah. Then there's a mitzvah to learn Torah totally abstractly. Have nothing to do. I learn korbanos. I learn things that have no practical meaning. So Rav Schechter didn't like that so much in our times. In other words, he felt, yeah, it's very nice after you've learned all the practical stuff, but very few people get to learn all the practical stuff. What are we spending, you know, all these, you know, wild stuff before we know the Aleph Beit? But okay, that's our system day. We teach, I don't know, Elam and whatever we teach, that isn't necessarily practical. But that non-practical aspect of Torah, that's where women are exempt. Of course, women are exempt. Doesn't mean they can't. I mean, that's the whole question. So today, women, Baruch Hashem, it's a very different society. But that mitzvah to learn Torah abstractly, the Gemara says women are exempt because you only have to teach your sons. You don't have to teach your daughters. And if you don't have to teach your daughter, if nobody has to teach you, then how are you going to learn? So you don't have something you don't have to learn, then you don't have to teach. But the whole idea of Torah in the Torah is about, teaching Torah. It's not about learning Torah. I think that's such a very important idea. We have no right to keep Torah to ourselves. That's, it gets into, there are halakhic questions about copyright in Torah. By the way, I mentioned haskamot before, writing, you know, approbations on books. People know what for hundreds of years, the original haskamot had nothing to do with the way the haskamas are today. You know what the original haskamot, quote unquote, were on books? Look at any book in the 17th, 18th century, what the Haskamas would often say. Or I know any book, but the Haskamas were basically copyrights. It was very expensive when printing first started. People had to outlay a lot of money, and they didn't know. There were some of the most famous disputes in halakhic literature. The famous dispute, I think, with the Raman, the reprinting of the Rambam, where the first guy sets it up and then somebody basically takes his work and print it for a lot cheaper and undercuts the original guy. He says, okay, I'm not going to publish books. And then it destroys, you know, then nobody wants to publish a book because they're afraid they can't recoup their cost. So the original Haskamot were basically bans on anybody to publish this book for 25 years or whatever until he sold out all the copies. And that was what the Haskamot were. They were basically commercial. What we would call, I don't know what we call restraint of trade, you know, basically patent, I guess we would call it. Get a patent agreement that for in America, we'd get a patent 17 years. It's different than Canada, but I think in America, right? We're in all the drug companies, right? It's a big thing here with a generic drug company can't, you know, produce the drug till X amount of years because otherwise drug companies, it's billions of dollars to invest in drugs. So that's what Haskamot used to be. It's very interesting. That was the original idea of Haskamot. But we had the books, but the idea, anyways, the mitzvah is to teach Torah, not so much learning Torah, but you that's what I'm saying, you can't keep Torah to yourself. Maybe for these reasons, for practical commercial reasons, can't publish other books, but it's generally assumed that people can spread your Torah. You have no right to keep Torah into yourself because God gave our Torah to teach it to others. Okay, but let's get back to my original question. What's the difference between Vishinantam Libanecha and Velimanatamatam Epinechem. Is there, you could say there isn't a difference. Okay, that's fine. Oh, but if there is a difference, what might it be? So I saw this Rabbi Wolgemuth, right? I occasionally quote him. Yeshaya Wolgemuth, some people even knew him here. He taught in Maimonides. He was from Berlin, the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, I believe, but he taught in Maimonides for many years, and Rav Soloveitchik tasked him with teaching the Siddur. And when he says the Wintmans, they come occasionally to classes on Torah Moshe. They sponsored the book he couldn't write. I think it was in his 90s already, but he orally sort of dictated the book. The people who put out the book, it just came out a year or two ago. So, he has in his book on prayer, his, commentary on the Siddur, very interesting that Vishinantam Lefanecha V'dibarta Bam is a father or perhaps today, a mother, a parent to a child. And you can hear it, the difference between the singular and the plural. Is the singular. To the plural, that is a Rebbe, that is a teacher-student relationship. In other words, we know that in the original way, the ideal way to learn Torah was, of course, a parent to a child. But there's also the idea of a Rebbe to a child. The Mishnah in Bava Metzia has this wild law. We once mentioned it, that you have to, if there's a lost object, that's what doing in Bava Metzia, in Eilu Metziot, that lost object, which is often the first Talmudic tractate, traditionally was the first Talmudic tractate people ever learned, because we want to teach the moral idea of Hashavat Aveda, returning lost object, whatever. Even though it's difficult, it's hard. So on one level, it makes no sense. You should start Brachot Megillah, or starting Eilu Metziot. Lieu Shalomi Dad, it's a very difficult concept. But that was the tradition in Europe that we started. That's how I began learning in grade 7 in an associated Hebrew school here in Toronto. Rabbi Trevin, I love Shalom, taught me Eilu Metziot Shalom Eilu Chayav La'achris. So later on in the chapter, the mission describes if you have a lost object of your teacher and your father, who do you return first? You know, you have to go here or there. Who are you going to go to first? New somebody. Everybody's afraid to answer. Don't be afraid to answer. That's why you have a 50-50 chance, even if you don't know.
Your father.
Of course, your father knew. So the Mishnah, of course, says don't leave now. Again, if you leave now, you'll miss the important thing. But the Mishnah says your teacher. Why? Sha'avi me'vil olam hazeh. Your father brings you into this world, but your teacher brings you into the world to come. Wow, what a powerful Mishnah. What a maybe striking, maybe upsetting Mishnah to many people. But your father brings you into this world, but your Rebbe, your teacher, brings you into the world to come.
What do you do if your father is also your teacher, though?
100% your father. 100% your father, for sure. We're talking about, as we'll see in a minute, we're talking about in the society of Rabbi Akiva before 40. I always like to stress, most Jews, through most of our history, were Rabbi Akiva before 40. Maybe they knew Aleph Beit, but maybe not. Because why do we repeat the Shemone Esrei? Because people didn't know how to say the Shemone Esrei. So I knew. So I would say there wasn't a printing press. Okay, wasn't a printing press. You say three times a day, how long does it take till you know it off by heart? People didn't know. They were farmers. They worked hard all day. There wasn't schools and they didn't know anything. Most people throughout Jewish history were ignorant. That's the bottom line. Most Jews today, most Jews who get a not so great yeshiva, a high school education, you know, from all our schools is great or not great as it is, know way more than the average Jew knew in the time of Rashi and Tosfot. We don't have people like Rashi and Tosfot. But the elite nowhere compares. But the Hamonam, the average person today for sure knows more than the average person throughout. We're the most educated generation in Jewish history. We may be also the greatest assimilation, but there, you know, the Daf Yomi, I mean, whoever, I've said many times, whoever heard of the average person opening up a Gemara? Never. Never more than 5%, unless ever opened up
a Gemara. Isn't that a small percentage of all the Jews?
I'm saying almost nobody ever opened Talmud.
No. But I'm talking about today. Aren't there many, many more Jews who know nothing or totally assimilated?
Yeah, we have assimilated Jews. We have assimilated Jews, of course. So I'm not really referring to them. I'm talking about people who identify as Jews. So I'm talking about in the time of the Mishnah, they went to Shul, but they didn't know how to read. They didn't know anything. The Irish farmer may have been observant, more or less. I mean, the Amaretz, that they're different what the Amaretz right. meant. And Amaretz in the Talmud often meant not so observant. Amaretz right. didn't just mean ignorant. In the Talmud, they didn't give trumat or masrot. They didn't put on tefillin. The Gemara is different explanation. So Amar is like the non-religious Jewish thing. But they were connected. So you have a lot of Jews today who are non-observant, not connected. I agree. You have a whole bunch who assimilate, are not connected. We're not really referring to those. But don't kid yourself. We've had that throughout history. Why are there only 12, 13, 14 million Jews in the world? It's not all Holocaust and pogroms and persecution. It's assimilation. Most Jews throughout history have assimilated. That's the bottom line. They don't teach you this, right? In Spain, right?
Lost the 10 tribes.
Most Jews in Spain stayed in Spain and assimilated. They didn't want to leave Spain. What, they're crazy? 1,000 years. So they were Muranos, whatever, for 100 years.
So you would
years.
Say that about the lost tribes?
Yeah, right. With our 10 lost tribes. There you go. 83.6, whatever it is. 5 out of 6, 86%. 86% of the Jews like that. That's higher than our assimilation rate. That's a lot worse. So don't kid yourself. Ein chadash tachat hashemesh. I always like to say half jokingly, but half seriously, we are the best proof of Darwin. We Jewish people, survival of the fittest. The fact that any Jew today is still a Jew, that's what I think Yitz Greenberg says more prominently, but lots of people, that a Jew is dedicated after the Holocaust. Wow, amazing. What amazing people we are. So the fact that anybody we're willing to put up with the hatred of the world and we're accused of genocide and all this, we're amazing people. We're proof of Darwin, only the fittest. The Jews who didn't have that level of faith or commitment fell by the wayside. What do you think? That was always the fear. When the Chatam Sofer is saying, when rabbis were afraid of leaving the ghetto, when Mendelssohn said, you got to leave the ghetto, and he said they were afraid because they knew you leave the ghetto, most Jews won't hack it out there. They're going to become non-Jews. It's true. It is true. Look, that's bad. But it's not any worse today. I don't think it's worse today than it was. I really don't. Again, I don't have exact numbers. I don't know if people have exact numbers. But we are, as Mark Shapiro once said, and I think he's so right, now I don't know if they talk about it, the off the derech, but people don't like that term anymore. But, people who were brought up observant become non-observant. The big, when Jewish Observer, whatever, in the 90s, or I don't exactly know, did their first big expose on the big off the derech problem of all these kids from yeshiva homes, leaving observant, and that became sort of part of our parlance. Off the derech, and what's her name, Margolis, wrote a whole book, Francine Margolis or something, I forget her name, wrote a whole book, Off the Derech and the Phenomena. So Mark said to me, he said, what are you talking about? We are the most on the derech generation in history. Since the time of the Enlightenment, we are the most on the derech. We are keeping our kids at much greater rates. Maybe today, less than 30 years ago, maybe. Probably, but every generation since emancipation. Look at your grandparents' generation. How many of your great aunts and uncles are observant? Everybody. I'm sure the answer is low among everybody here. You came to America. You had 4 kids. If one remained, Shomer Shabbos, they were doing pretty good. If 2 remained, Shomer Shabbos, you're doing amazing. As Mark also pointed out, there was only, as he knows, only 1 rabbinic family. At the turn of the century, the 20th century, I have to check the exact dates. You can go by them one by one. Only 1 rabbinic family, he claims, kept all their kids observant. That's Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Soloveitchik family. Every other family of Gedolei Torah, I don't want to start mentioning names. It's no reflection on them. But every Gadol that you know of has siblings who are not religious. Every one of them, I think. I know a number of cases because the people went to yeshiva at 12, 13. So they were in a different world. They left their families and the rest of the family became non-observant. That's the way it was. All the Gedolei Torah have non-observant relatives. Today, less so, much less so. Today, some of these people have never met a non-observant Jew. And that's part of the ways in Judaism has become so moving to the right, whatever you call them, because they don't deal with people who are, you know, are less observant. They live in a cocoon, not only just observant people, people who spend their whole life learning in yeshiva. They don't even meet people who work for a living in our observance. So it's a very different set. Anyways, that's way too off topic. But anyway, so it is important that, but anyways, let's get back to, so most students, that's what I was saying, were like Rabbi Akiva before the age of 40. So you have to honor your teacher more than your parent. But if your father teaches you also, which was rare, then of course you honor your father first. Absolutely. Even if your father teaches you, or your mother, even if it teaches you less than your Rebbe. Your Rebbe teaches you more, but your father. But the most important part, and that's why I told everybody, I hope nobody left. I told people not to leave. The most important part is that was in an era when education was free, when nobody took money for teaching Torah. In an era today where you pay, I don't know, $43,000. I don't want to start naming the schools. Where, you know, between $20,000 and $50,000. I was talking to, I remember a few weeks ago, I was in Montreal. So my friend of mine, so his sister, who I know, has his, their kids in Heschel in New York. She has Heschel's tuition, I think, is almost $55,000 a year. I said, a lot of people don't pay it. But it's like unbelievable, you know, like, so when parents are paying, even if they're paying only $20,000 a year, your parents are teaching you Torah. The teacher is just the messenger. He's the agent of the parent. But for sure, even if the father doesn't know an aleph from a beit, but if the parents are writing a check for $20,000 or $10,000 to the school, you for sure have to give the parents first. So that's a very important point. We're talking about a situation where the Rebbe taught for free and he was willing to teach your student for free. Then, okay, in such a situation, and the father knows nothing. So the kid would be a total ignorant without the teacher. So in that very rare circumstance that we no longer have today, that's what the Mishnah says. You have to honor the parent, the teacher before the parent. Okay, so but it's interesting. So that's what Rabbi Wogelmuth quotes, that the first paragraph of Shema is a sort of a higher level of learning. That's when a kid, you know, coming from a learned family, the father's going to sit down with the kid, or what was often common, you know, historically, the great before, thank God we have today, education en masse for the women of our community, Baruch Hashem. We know many men didn't get such a great education in Europe. Most men went to work. 12, 13, you became an apprentice. Very few men, forget women, learned Torah beyond their bar mitzvahs in any systematic way. That's, I'm talking 80 years ago. I'm not talking like ancient history, right? The women who were learned in the last 100 years were often women who had no brothers. This is well known. You can name some of the people. There were no brothers, so the father would often learn Torah with his daughter. He couldn't have learned Torah with his son. And that's how some of these daughters became quite learned. Anyways, okay, so let's just show a little bit. I think it's a well-known Gemara, although I don't know, maybe people here have not seen the Gemara. It's a very important Gemara, and that's the Gemara about how Jewish education began. So we're assuming we're going to go with this idea. The second paragraph of Shema is talking about the teacher-student relationship as opposed to the parent child relationship. So just let's take a quick look here. Let me share my screen. Tell me how many people learn the Gemara in Bava Batra of all places. Okay. Let's have to into what it's doing in Bava Batra, which talks on property rights. Okay, it's talking about where you can open up schools and business. Are you allowed to open up very modern? Are you allowed to open up a store in your basement, in your courtyard? The neighbors complain that we have commercial areas, residential areas. So there's a whole discussion, and the Gemara says, what about opening up a school? Maybe teaching Torah is different than opening up a manufacturing plant. But anyway, the Gemara in this discussion quotes Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav. Rav, of course, is the first generation of the Amorim. So we're talking of the early third century. Rav is a student of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the final editor of the Mishnah. Rav is living in Babel. Rabbi Yehuda is his student. Rabbi Yehuda was a student of Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel are contemporaries. Rav Yehuda is quoted, perhaps the most, I don't know, one of the most often quoted in the Talmud. And half the time he's quoting Rav and half the time he's quoting Shmuel, because he learned with both of them. And one was in Surah, one was in Pumbedita. Anyways, and Naharda, okay, first. Okay, Baram, anyway, or whatever, they trusted her truly, as the case may be. Zachura toa ish letov, remember this person for good. It's such a interesting expression. Right, remember this person for good, for Yoshua ben Gamla Shmo. So how many people here have heard of Yoshua ben Gamla? I imagine the number, right? I'm sure there are people here who have not heard of Yoshua ben Gamla. Right? Those who have not heard of Rabbi Yoshua ben Gamla. How can that be? The Gemara says, you have to remember him. The Gemara says, remember Yoshua ben Gamla. Everybody, there should be schools on the building instead of whatever his name, it should be Yoshua ben Gamla. Yoshua ben Gamla's name should be on every school auditorium. Why? She'il melehu, if not for him, nishtakach Torah Yisrael. This is one of the most like mind-blowing pieces of Talmud. Even if you've learned this 10 times, this is like, just think about it. If not for Yoshua ben Gamla, who have to be, most people have never heard of, there would be no Torah. The Torah would have been forgotten from the Jewish people. You want to say the Gemara is exaggerating. I don't know. I don't know if it's exaggerating, but even if it is exaggerating, wow. The Torah would have been forgotten. Why? Why? Shabbat chila, originally, mi she'esh lo'av, a person who had a father, the father taught him Torah. Mi she'ein lo'av, it could mean, unfortunately, one who mamish didn't have a father. People died young. People didn't have a father. Or it could mean he didn't have a learned father. Lo lamad Torah. They didn't learn. you're born in the wrong family. Tough. Too bad. You're not going to learn. If you have a born family with money, you have money. Born family with no money, if your parents can send you to university, you go. If not, not. Where you're born, that's going to determine your life. That's the way life works. It's still true to a large extent. My Darush, so what did he do? What did he expound upon? To limanatem otam. But it says you should teach them. Limanatem. You should learn. You have to teach them. You have to learn. So what did he do? This is like very funny. So they set up schools in Jerusalem. Right? Because the verse says, from out of Zion shall come forth Torah. Okay. You want to learn Torah? Go to Jerusalem. Very nice. But so very good. Who's going to go to Jerusalem? It costs money. Your parents have to take you. So someone whose father would schlep him to Jerusalem, he would take him and he would learn Torah. Mishain Loav, he didn't have a father to take him, so he stayed in Haifa, in Tel Aviv. He didn't go to, I know that's anachronistic. He didn't go to Yerushalayim. Hikinu Sheyu Moshevi Mechua Pelech Upelech. They instituted that in every city. In every town, they had to institute a school, which were free, of course. In other words, the community had to pay for it. When it says hikinu, it means it was the taxes the community collected. Like in every normal society, there you go to school, you go to public school. That's what it means. Public school is free. So there's supposed to be public Jewish education. Jewish education is supposed to be free. Unfortunately, we don't listen to this Gemara, whatever, just the way it is. When we had a different society in Europe 100 years ago, it was different. You pay tax. So you pay in Germany, we discussed, you paid 9% tax. So 9% of your money went to the Protestant, Catholic, to the Jews. So 9% of your tax dollars, of your income would go to the Jewish community. And the Jewish community would fund the mikveh and the yeshiva and the shul. And that's, of course, what Shinshon Raphael Hirsch petitioned, that there should be two Jewish communities. We're not part of that Jewish community. We don't want when we say Hirsch separated from the Jewish community, create Ostrich, his own Jewish separatist community. That's what it meant. It meant that Jews could allocate their tax dollars to his community, and they would take care of their own needs. But it was free. Everybody, their taxes paid. But we don't have that in America. It doesn't work. So that was pretty old. 16, 17, right. Very interesting. If their teacher got mad, Aina kaptan melamed, right? You're not supposed to get teachers who have a temper. Aina baishan lomed, the shy student can never learn. And the kaptan, the person who's makbid, he's very, you know, insistent, thin skin, whatever you want to urge, gets angry, can't learn. But no, we know that happened. Mevai, he kicked him. He kicked him and he left. He threw him out of class. Acheba Yoshua ben Gamla. Now, Rabbi Shuga said, this is crazy. Vediteng, and he made an ordinance. Shiyumo shivim melamdei tinoko b'chol medina medina. Plak was bigger in every little town, u'b'chol ir v'ir, in every province, in every city, like, you know, in the Megillah. Medina ir v'ir, medina medina, mishpacha, mishpacha, we already have. So you have the medina medina, ir v'ir. And that, you don't wait till 16, 17 to start education. That's ridiculous. So you start in grade one, given sheish, okay, or sheva, 6, 7. They didn't have kindergarten. They started in grade one. Okay. The Seder. And, so that's what the Gemara says. This is an unbelievable Gemara. Now, by the way, does anybody know when Yoshua ben Gamla lived? Rav, he's living before. So I didn't quote the Gemara, but his mother, well, it was his mother, Helen Lihamaka. It's a Mishnah in Yuma. I don't want to spend time. I'll look it up later. It's clear he lived just as the temple was being destroyed. He became the Kohen Gadol, wow. I believe. It was the year, I believe this happened in the year 66. In other words, you know, people say, now's not the time. We're in the middle of a war with the Romans. We can't do other things. You got to focus all our energies on the war. No. We're focusing our energies on education. It's unbelievable, right? You know what? Let me spend half a second, if you don't mind. Maybe I'll find. If I don't find it right away, I'll save it for next week. But just give me a second. Let me look here and find the Mishnah Yuma.
I just read yesterday, Rabbi Sachs, in this week's Parsha, writes that it's focused on the future, on the children, on education.
Of course, that's the most important thing, Jewish education. One of my favorite halachot is that where's Yuma here? Why am I missing you? Okay. That even if they tell you they're building the Beit HaMikdash and the Mashiach is here, it's very nice. You don't stop the shiur. You keep going on. This is, somebody else can build the Beit HaMikdash. You'll meet the Mashiach later. Big deal. Meet the Mashiach. You're learning Torah. We don't interrupt Torah for meeting the Mashiach. That's, pretty wild. Okay. So here, if I remember correctly, Ben Katin, okay, Munvaz. Okay. Yeah, so it's not right here. I think Helene Mo, this is it, but it doesn't say here. So maybe it's more. Okay, I have to look up the exact source. I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure this, I remember, and I did this in the year, around the year 66, which is like unbelievable. This is when Yoshua ben Gamla. So Yoshua, that's for Liman Tamatam Epinechem, that there's a communal obligation. And remember, it's obvious. If you look at the whole Parsha, Vahaptat Hashem, the first Parsha, is really talking to individuals. You should love the Lord your God. Vahaptat Hashem HaKab, B'chol Levavcha. The second paragraph is B'chol Nafshechem, and it's very plural. What's going to happen to the Jewish people? The Jewish people are going to be exiled. So they're sort of the individual, and that's how we work. There's an individual obligations in mitzvot, and then there's our communal obligations. So there is an individual obligation on a parent to teach Torah to their child, but there's a communal obligation to make sure that every Jewish child has access for free, ideally, whatever, to Jewish education. And if not for this, Torah would have been forgotten from the Jewish people. It's such a powerful statement. It almost sounds like the Gemara knew that nobody would remember Yoshua ben Gamla. In other words, we're talking 150 years later, right? Rav Yehuda is quoting Rav. It's almost 200 years later. What he's quoting him said, I want everybody to remember this person, probably because he had been forgotten. In other words, you know, if you have to tell people, I want you to remember this person because nobody's remembering him. So the Gemara puts it in, but remember this person. And then they say, if not for him, you know, all the Torah you have, yeshivas and Babel, nothing, wouldn't exist. Without the sacrifices of our parents and our grandparents, like the generation of survivors who built up American Jewry. I grew up like a spoiled brat, like, you know, everything was all done for me. But the people who came in the 40s, and there was nothing in America. And America was mamish, a desert. And I don't mean a spoiled brat, I mean in terms of sense that it was easy to be a Jew. The people had raised, you know, had put the foundations, but those people who laid the foundations, they sacrificed a lot. We're standing on their shoulders. Or as, the rabbis who came here and struggled mightily. And then now, people don't even, there's no appreciation how hard it was to be a Shomer Shabbos in America in 1940. People have no appreciation of that today. And I've said many times, that's why so many stringencies because, it's easy. The basics are easy. So they're looking for new things. They used to be the basics were hard. Anyways, that's what it means that, there is, you have to teach Torah to children. There's a communal obligation to teach Torah to everybody. It's a very, important idea. Okay. In order that we should have lengths of days here, let's pull up the Shema a little bit, even though sometimes if I'm not in the right frame of mind, I don't say it by heart properly. Right. Where are we here? Okay. So, you should teach your children again, like in the first prayer, in your home, when you're going on the street, that's what he adds, the idea that if this is public education, but still in the home, the parents, in other words, there's this combination. The parents have to review. You can't rely only on public education. That's what he adds in the, in his explanation. We have a public system, but we know the public system, things fall through the cracks. The public school system, meaning a Jewish public school system, there are 25 kids in the class. As a matter of fact, there are halakhas. The Rambam writes, what's a class size? 25. From 25 to 40, we wouldn't tolerate this in our school so much here. 25 to 40, you have an assistant teacher. And from 40, you divide the class into two classes of 20. Very, not so distant from modern educational theory. And these halakhas are written. How do you run the class? No, there are 25 kids in the class. There are different levels. It doesn't work that way. So the parent can't just rely on what kids learn in yeshiva. The parent has to supplement the education if they can. Anyways, okay. Again, the mezuzah, leman yibru yimechem yimebinechem. So what does the word leman mean? What's leman mean? Your buyamekam, you should have long life and life of your children on this land. So we're going back to Israel, assuring that God has promised like the heaven and the earth. I don't know what that means. What does kimei hashemayim al haaretz mean? It's we say it every day, but what in the world does it mean? Okay, anybody want to, what's that paragraph saying? Leman yibuyamekam yibuyamekam, leman. So the word leman generally means for the sake of. For the purpose of leman yedu dorotechem ki besukot hoshavti epnei Yisrael. Why do we say it in the sukkah leman? In order that, for the purpose of that, we should know, and that's the famous the halacha, the Bach, the tour quotes that there are three mitzvot you have to have.
Leman yarichun yamecha.
Right. We have it, leman tizkeru. We're going to have it in the third paragraph of the Shema. We're getting leman tizkeru basitim, basitim kol mitzvotai. That's on tzitzis. And then you have it by tefillin. This week's Parsha. I'm in Parsha Bo. Leman tiyat torat Hashem beficha. You put on tefillin, you put a sign on your arm for the sake of leman. So the tour is the forerunner of the Shulchan Aruch. The tour of Yaakov Bal Haturim, we call him, the rose, the Arba Turim, the four rows, which of course he got from the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, four robes of the 12 tribes were in four rows, and that's the Arba Turim, the Choshen Mishpah, the breastplate, of course, it already tells you the way to get close to God is through business law, that's the most important trait. I don't say it enough here, I say it when I teach here in chat all the time, that the definition of a religious Jew is honesty in business, not kashrut and Shabbos, that's not really it. That's why the first question is nasata v'natata v'emunah, right? Our business dealings express our faith in God. Someone who cheats, we're all a little, it's hard to believe in God. It's hard not to be a little bit of an atheist. But somebody who cheats a little means they don't really believe in God, because we believe God determines how much money you're going to make, right? Everybody works hard. Some people are lucky and less lucky, right? For every billionaire out there, there are 100 people just as smart who worked just as hard and just as educated, but they didn't get that lucky break, that, you know, some tipping point, something happened and their idea took off. You know, Bill Gates, all these people. They're smart, but, some people got messed up by COVID because they're in the wrong business. Or if you're United Airlines and you own Boeing airplanes, so you're going to lose a lot of money because Boeing doesn't know how to build airplanes anymore. So that's luck. That's luck. So we believe that's God. In other words, God determines what that's going to be. So if you cheat, it means you want to outsmart God, it means you don't really believe in God. That's what the Gemara says, that God determines between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur how much money you're going to have. It's hard. It's hard to believe that, but that's what it means to really believe in God. So nasata benatata be'emunah. Where your give and take, that's right. The first question, the Talmud says that the 120, God will ask us six questions. And the first question, nasata benatata, did you give and take? Nasav matan is the word for business. Masav really means to elevate. And nasi is a president. Naso, lift up. So business, money is supposed to lift us up spiritually. It's an opportunity to become great spiritual people, conducting business honestly, treating our employees, our competitors, our customers in a proper way, paying a proper salary, etc. So that is the way you elevate. Masa umatan, you give to others, right? And we give, we all gain. That's what masa umatan. That's why business masa umatan. The emunah means faith. Well, what do you mean faith? Was your masa umatan, was your business dealing elevated? Was it done that show that you demonstrate belief in God? Or did you try to cut corners because you think you can outsmart God? But anyways, that's why Choshen Mishpat is the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. That's why the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch called the laws of business ethics Choshen Mishpat, right? It's, if you think about it, it's unbelievable. What they're teaching us, the central, the way God communicated with the Kohen Gadol through the Urim Bitumim in the Choshen Mishpat was, and that's what we're going to say for, we deal with our monetary law. So they're obviously telling us something very important. It's monetary law. It's how we deal with our money that gets us closer to God. And notice most of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch are taken from this. The Avnei Miluim and the Urim Bitumim of Rav Yonatan Leibschitz. A lot of the Sfarim took their names from the Kohen's breastplate. That became the way the Avnei Nezer, all these things, you know, are connected. Anyway, okay, so that's, what are we saying all this, right? So that's so what's Leman Yerbu? So, why was I saying all this? Because, the word Leman, so by Tfilin, by Sukkah is for the purpose of Leman Tia Torah Hashem Beficha. The word Leman always means, you have to know why you're doing it. So the Torah, I was telling you who the Torah is, right? That's where it all started. So the Torah quotes, this is in Or HaChaim, in Hilchot Sukkah, that when you sit in the Sukkah, you have to know why you're sitting in the Sukkah. I don't have to know why I eat matzah. I'm going to read tomorrow, right? It's nice to know why I eat matzah, but I don't know why I eat matzah. Jews eat matzah. I'm pretty assimilated. The Seder is one time you're going to get a lot of Jews who are not so connected. They don't really know, but they know we eat matzah. Beautiful. But if you sit in the Sukkah and you don't know why you sit in the Sukkah, you don't fulfill the mitzvah of Sukkah. That's how the Torah writes. And the Bach explained because of the word Leman, or the Sekab. So it has that by Tfilin, by Tzitzis, and by Sukkah. Very interesting that all three mitzvot women are exempt. I actually didn't think about that before. These three mitzvot are three classic examples of mitzvot to say she has man grama, but leman yirbu, leman means for the purpose of, the sake of. So what does it mean in our context? Teach Torah, put on tefillin, mezuzah, teach. Leman yirbu yimekam, so that you will have long life. That's what's very interesting. That's what leman yirbu yimekam al adamah. So the question is this talking to individuals, like honor your parents, you'll have long life? Or is this talking to the Jewish people? Leman yirbu yimekam al adamah. We're not talking about any individual Jew. We're talking that if the Jewish people, we said the second paragraph is really in the public. The first paragraph of Shema is in the singular, talking about individuals. So the simple meaning, it's not talking about any individual Jew. It's talking about the Jewish people. The Jew, right? Be careful so God doesn't exile us as a people. If we are, wherever we are, we have to keep the mitzvot. We have to teach our children. And if you do this, you will then come back to the lab. Remember, we were just thrown out of the lab. Right? Be very careful. You're going to get thrown out of the lab. You still have to keep mitzvah when you're thrown out of the lab. And then you do that, the man you bring back, then God will bring you back to the land. So you're going to have length of days on this land. So that's the simple meaning that it's talking about the Jewish people as a whole. Nonetheless, many of the commentaries, not surprisingly, I would say, do associate it with individual life. One of them, the Otzer Atfilat Siddur quotes, when you say this, you should think of the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. Very interesting, right? Because we know there are only very few mitzvot where the Torah promises long life. One of them is honoring parents. So leman yirbu yimechem, you should think of the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, because that also has length of days. You want to have a long life? Honor your parents. If you remember, a number of weeks ago, we discussed that according to the opinion, right, it's a little bit surprising for me, for all of us, that according to one opinion, Talmud, which seems to be the simple meaning, really, the mitzvah of Shema is only a rabbinic mitzvah. When you lie down, when you get up, that's not talking about saying Shema, which is how we interpret it. You have to say Shema in the morning, evening. It's talking about teaching Torah, b'shinat l'menecha, right? And that's why the Gemara has an opinion that the reciting of Shema is a rabbinic mitzvah. The rabbi, okay, we keep rabbinic mitzvah, but the biblical mitzvah is learning Torah. The halakha accepts the opinion that it is a biblical mitzvah, but anyways, it is very interesting that the real mitzvah here is, right, teaching Torah. And so if it's a rabbinic mitzvah, why do we say it? So the Talmud Yerushalmi, we quoted this a number of weeks ago, but it's always good to review. So the Talmud Yerushalmi says, you know why we say Shema? Not because it's not a mitzvah in the Torah that's talking about learning Torah. We say Shema. This is the Jerusalem Talmud. Mifnei ma korin shtei parshiot halalu. So we don't even know if they have the third paragraph here. Rabbi Simon Amar Vnei Shekatu Meshkiva Vekima. Okay. Rav Levi, this is Mipnei Aseret Hadibrot Klulimba. Because the Ten Commandments, right? The Aseret Hadibrot, not literally the Ten Commandments, right? The Aseret Hadibrot are here. And we went through this a number of weeks ago. Anochi, Ishma Yisrael, Loya. And they go through, because the Talmud says we wanted to say that put the Aseret Hadibrot in the Shema every day, but they took it out because of the heretics, because the heretics were claiming, the Ten Commandments, you know, who cares about the other 603 commandments? So the rabbis removed the Aseret Dibrot and they snuck it back in, so to speak, indirectly by the Shema. So that's just a fascinating comment. It's there, so that makes a lot of sense. So when you say Leman Yirbu Yimechem, you think of the mitzvah in the Torah. Okay, you can think of sending away the mother bird also, but I guess the more common and more applicable for people to think about Kibud Av V'Em when you say Leman Yirbu. So that's also interpreting in the personal vein, although the simple meaning seems to be it's on the communal vein. If the Jewish people as a whole, they will come back. Some also point out you have here the three most important blessings of life, which are long life, good, healthy life, with children, and economic success. That's what Leman Yirbu Yimechem, Vimei Beneichem, and your children, Ala Dama, will be Kimei Shemai Art, very successful life. That's what we all pray for, family success and economic blessing. So that's so that's the idea of Leman Yirbu Yimechem. But again, the Torah is connecting our observance of mitzvot to living in Israel. Living in Israel is connecting our performance of mitzvot. What does Kimei Hashemayim Al Haaretz mean? Like the days of the heaven on the earth. It's a very strange expression.
It's an eternal commitment.
What's an eternal? So our mitzvah would have to be an eternal commitment.
No, this promise from God.
And what's the promise? What's the promise? If we're good, we'll be in the land.
In the land and God's covenant with us.
There is no real. I'm sure.
About keeping this mitzvah, about being with us, the whole, the whole package.
So, right. It's a little bit unclear.
The commitment
It's not all package. It's not all package. There were two conditions. Abraham asked Hashem that we will never go to Galut. The other one, that he will keep in touch with us all the time. So only the second one, that's the commitment that Hashem promised. In fact, we are in Galut.
So what some say, it's along the lines of what Debbie is saying, I think, is that if the Jewish people keep me,
we keep our part forever.
The same way the heavens and the earth, they said the same way the heaven is on top of the earth always, like the eternity of nature. Hazinu Hashemayim Ba'adabera. That Moshe Rabbeinu invokes the heaven and the earth. It's an eternal covenant. So God is making an eternal promise to the Jewish people that we can be in Israel permanently. The idea that also heaven and earth take this slightly different. Heaven and earth are inseparable, right? Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. Even though, like, then God, he split them. He divided them too. But the shamayim ve'et ha'aretz is like one unit. So too, the Jewish people should be inseparable from the land of Israel. Of course, it hasn't always been that way. There is one fascinating explanation, which we'll sort of have to end with, the idea that that the heavens determines what happens on earth. In other words, if it doesn't rain, the heavens is where our climate comes from. Rain, you know, all this stuff. Timei Shemayim Balaretz. So the same way the heavens determine what life is like on earth, the Jewish people are like the central being that sort of are supposed to influence the whole earth, right? We discussed last week, we're supposed to be an Or LeGoyim. We even quoted the opinion that the reason we were exiled, the Talmud says that, and Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch picked up on this a lot. He liked this idea that we were sent into exile to collect converts. It goes against the grain of how we were normally taught, but that's one. It's one opinion. Of course, not everybody agrees with that opinion. But the Talmud and Pesachim says, so the idea that that we should be an Or LeGoyim, everybody agrees. Everybody agrees. So okay, the same way the Shemayim and the Aretz, sort of one influence the other, the Jewish people have to influence the world at large, which is sort of, and we do that through Torah. We discussed last week, the nation of the world. We're very impressed. We do that by building a society which is the leading moral society and leading economic society, right? People will see morality and success go together. That's the bottom line mission of the Jewish people. And I said it a few times. That's why we had to be slaves in Egypt. We had to learn the good of Egypt. Egypt had a lot of good. Egypt was the technology about the leading the super of the world. There's great things to learn from Egypt, but there are also great things to learn not to do from Egypt. But we need that greatness. We need the greatness of science and technology and economic success and leadership. We need all that, not religious, quote unquote. I mean, it is religious, but not the way the world views it. And of course, that has to be coupled with our moral success. And when they go together, that's what God is saying. If we're morally, we live the moral life we must live, we follow the mitzvot of Torah, which are to lead ethical and moral lives, to be honest in business, to have the choshen mishpat, nasata venatata b'emuna, then God will bless us with economic success. And then we can influence the whole world. Then we can be a model nation. We want people to look up to Israel to say how great we're the first field hospital. There's a lot to discuss here, obviously, and a lot what's going on today in the world, how the world, unfortunately, is viewing Israel in many ways. But I still think we have a lot of friends out there. They're not as loud, but I think there are a lot of people who are supporting that should continue. Okay, let's just do a quick review, and then I'll take the question. We talked about you have to teach your children. And we basically said that there's the individual obligation to teach, and then there's the communal obligation to teach. And that communal obligation to teach was Yeshua ben Gamla, that he insisted that everybody, we have to set up free public school systems. If not him, there would be no Torah left in the Jewish people. We've had assimilation always in Jewish history, but a parent who pays for Torah, even though in theory the one who teaches Torah is on a higher level than even a parent, because they bring the world to come. If the parent facilitates the teaching, they pay tuition, then obviously the father comes first, and obviously the parents come first, even if they teach a little bit. So we discussed that, the setting up of our school system, the importance of our financial in integrity. Leman yirbu, the word leman is for the sake of, with the purpose. Whenever the Torah uses word leman means you've got to know what you're doing there. What's the goal here? Leman yedu, we have to know. We have to understand. Leman tisku, we should leman yerbu. So here, the goal is God wants the Jewish people to be on the land of Israel so we can influence the whole world. We can only have our national flourishing if we are together in the state of Israel. And that's nature. That's how it's like the Shemaim art. That's the natural way of the world. For much of our history, it's not natural, right? Living in exile is not natural. No way it's supposed to be. We got used to it. Okay, what can we do? Okay, anyways, let me just quickly take questions. High school morning, we discussed that. Yeah, Rav Rogenwood was revered in Maimonides. Okay, yes, I believe everybody was. Thank you, Justin. Like I say, of course, I never met him, but I know from people who went to Maimonides. Okay, that's why Chassidut emerged. What is why Chassidut has emerged? Learn because just doing robotic mitzvah, right, without understanding. The Chassidic emerged for lots of reasons. It was a critique of the elitist society of the sort of misnagdish world, which was elitist and focused on Torah. This focused on cheerfulness, on song, on connection. I don't know if it was so much on the reasons for mitzvah, it was the joy of mitzvah. I think that's what Chassidut said. We can be happy. We can dress like the noble people. We can sing. We can dance. You don't have to be so learned. That they I don't know if they stress the why mitzvah. They stress, don't worry about it. Just follow your Rebbe, dance and sing and be happy. So I'm not sure if the Hasidus stressed the understanding of mitzvot. But it is important to understand what the pots and pans. I mean, listen, the brisker derech that the Torah learning at the concept is very popular because it's very analytical, it's very scientific, it goes with our scientific age. Rav Soloveitchik spoke about that all the time. But whether that's, you know, the more important way, so that's, listen, there was a whole journal of the Orthodox Forum on the Brisker Derech revisited like 100 years later. What are the critiques? What are its successes, not successes? Okay, yeah, somebody just writing me privately that their whole family, no one's observant in their family. Of course, what percentage of Jews today are observing this? It's rising. Part of it is rising because the assimilation rate is high. We're having more kids like we've never had before. It's probably 20-30% are Shomer Shabbos today. In America, a little bit less than in Israel, probably nearing 20%. That's how you define it. Yeah, it's much higher. It used to be 5%. That's what somebody writing me privately. When each Jew keeps the Torah with claw with function, then one doesn't see themselves as a peg on the wheel. Right. Yeah, when we're part of a system, it empowers us. Absolutely. I think that's what you're saying. That's why Daf Yomi is so popular, because you feel you're part of a whole community, hundreds of thousands of people. You have a mission, a goal, right? So when a person connects himself to the Jewish people and sees the Jewish people with a purpose, that's wonderful, correct? What is the impact North American Jewish family, individual Jews who are choosing to read home as adults by learning Torah? Yeah, okay, we'll have to talk about that. Janine, you're talking about, there is a great impact. The Jews who are returning, the Belt Shuva movement has had a tremendous influence. I don't have time to discuss the whole thing now. I'm not an expert in that area, but the Belt Shuva movement, it's had a big influence on the Hamonam. It hasn't had any influence in the yeshiva world. It hasn't had any influence in the elite of the yeshivas, you know, but in terms of out there in the, and for the people, that's all that tremendous influence. Okay. Today's education landscape, there's a growing appreciation for the broad spectrum of knowledge. Yes, the verse of Germans called by college education. Yeah, I hope so. I don't know. That's also changing. This raised significant concern about the spiritual well-being of young impressionable men. Yeah. Listen, the reason there is so much against college, right, the idea of college is we expose you to all ideas. And I think that's wonderful. I think, right, many Jews are not prepared for that. If Torah can't stand up to college, we're in big trouble. I believe the Chorsky parents, they sent, you know, Yitzchak Chorsky, the Talmud Rebbe, the Rebbe's the Mechutin of the Rebbe. The parents are the Mechutanim. The son-in-law, Yitzchak Chorsky, went to Boston Latin, some fancy private school in Boston for high school. So they said, his parents, why send them to like a Jewish school? They said, if after the
Boston Latin school was public education, Rabbi.
Right. That's the point. They said, if we haven't given,
but it wasn't private.
Okay, it wasn't private, public, fine. But I'm saying if he's going to be turned off by Torah just because he's exposed to that, then there's something wrong with how we teach Torah. So that's a pretty amazing thing. We shouldn't be afraid of college. Truth is truth. If you're searching for truth, listen, college is galore. I don't have to tell you all the problems on college campuses, but I do have to leave in a second. But, you know, it isn't, but we shouldn't be afraid of from anywhere. And we have to learn how to expose our kids. That's what modern Orthodoxy believes in. That's why Avraham moved to Gvar. We want to expose people. If you keep them sheltered, then it is dangerous. Absolutely is dangerous. Okay, the Taz, the reason for the Sukkah, it's actually the Bach who says that. Love Hashem. Okay, you know what? I apologize, but I have to go teach now. I'm just running a little bit late. Balei Teshuva did bring a lot of freshness. I totally agree. They do bring, and they brought a lot of talents that regular people learning Shiva don't have. Some of the Balei Teshuva, because of their broader experience, it enriches Judaism, which also we have to think about what that means for a yeshiva education, that we have to rely on Balei Teshuva for so much things that they don't get. Yes, they for sure enriched a lot. Okay, I'm going to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. David, I apologize that I can't really address your question right now, but please, God, I'll address it in the future. And okay, everybody
Shabbat
have
Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Okay, good news. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye. Be well, everybody.
Bye.